So, if you know anybody in the music industry, you know that the music industry is pretty exploitative. You spend lots of time working on a piece, and then you have to play it over and over and over again. And it's very hard to distribute, and it's hard to monetize. And as you go further upwards in the music industry, or you're dealing with other acts and other bands, and you're dealing with venues, and you're dealing with, of course, record labels. These relationships can be more and more exploitative because these established groups can apply a lot of leverage to the work that you make. And they get a lot of control over the music. They get a lot of control over the writing. They get a lot of control over your merchandise, your image, and your time. These guys can send you on the road for 300 days out of the year, and you don't have the time to build a local fan base or to spend time with your family. Just a lot of your own destiny is out of your own hands once you've given this art to the world. And this goes doubly when you're talking about your own life and your own situations, the social issues that impact your life. The nonprofit industrial complex is huge, and it has a lot of the same issues with ownership. Who is telling your story? Who's in charge of that story? Who's in charge of how it's told, shared, distributed? And maybe just as importantly, how do you tell your story? How do you gain just the support structure to talk about your life experiences in a way that connects with your family, your neighborhood, your community? I got to talk to Cheryl Buchanan at the Boston nonprofit organization Writers Without Margins, and these guys hold free collaborative workshops at really unconventional spaces, communities that are isolated by the challenges of racism, addiction recovery, trauma, poverty, disability, mental illness, and working with them in a collaborative way to share their life and share their stories. And they do that, and they publish yearly journals of poetry written by people who've been to these workshops and have been able to talk about their life and their experiences in really raw and candid ways. I loved talking to Cheryl. And in fact, we're working on a film screening together. If you're listening to this, next month, February 27th, we're going to be streaming a film called In Their Shoes. And it's a film presented by Writers Without Margins that tracks four men who are in a workshop for addiction recovery and reentry from prison. And over the course of an hour and some change, you get to hear these returning citizens talk about their work, their family, society as a whole, and just their life experience in their own words. And it can be a lot more valuable than reading a policy paper or reading from Washington politicians about who these people are and how they should be treated. And this is really hard work to bring attention to. So I was able to talk to Cheryl about how do you find those connections both locally and in other cities. I was pleasantly surprised to see so many connections to the work done in Atlanta and people inside of the city who, of course, have so many of the same struggles that they're dealing with. My conversation with Cheryl is really awesome, and I really hope that you enjoy listening to it. About just the week. How has the week been in your life? Obviously, like I know a little bit about Writers Without Margins and the work that you guys do. I looked at your YouTube channel and all of that was lovely. But what's the newest news?
Jeez, the week. It's only Tuesday. So I can work backwards in the immediacy. I just got back from a workshop, and I'm first of all impressed that you looked at our visibility, what's out there in the public that showed up quickly in your message. So I appreciate that, because I'm sure as a organization, you get all sorts of marketing emails as well, and most of them are very apparent that they have no idea who you are, and they're just blasting the world. So it was clear to me that you had actually taken a look at who we are. So I want to say that first and foremost, thank you. I just got back from a workshop at a recovery center in downtown Boston that is more of a drop-in center, I would say, than a recovery center for unsheltered folks who are battling addiction and all of the challenges of homelessness and often likely mental health complications as well. And that is different every time we show up. So I think a little bit of my own personal mantra is to be overprepared and adaptive. And it is hard to shake that. So when I say I just got back from that, there's always different people and different stories that we encounter when we go in there. And that's what's running through my head right now when you asked me that question. I was like, the week, it's more like the current state of humanity that I just walked in and out of. So that happened.
Are you still in the state of you're really taking in that moment from the past? Or are you also thinking about what can I do now with what I now have experienced? Or what is the balance like? Because I'm sure you're thinking of both a little bit.
I'm thinking of both. It's always feels like a responsibility and an honor and an obligation to both process and share what I personally, individually just, you know, encountered and experienced and felt. And we just launched a book that is a collection that we do annually of our writer's work. And I also brought that in today. And we had 6 out of our 38 contributors were from that particular workshop. So I brought that in to show to folks that we had done and that it was ready and that it was complete. And also some of the new people that were there were really excited to see it and know that that's something that they could be part of if they, I don't want to say consistently, but you know, continually or ever showed up in that space again. So that was exciting. You know, there's always things that are both inspiring and heartbreaking in those rooms. So I'm always looking at like both, what is it that I'm doing right now and how might I be able to, I'm also thinking about what is our conversation about, how might I be able to share this with a larger or wider or bigger, for lack of a better word, audience, you know, in the world. And when I say it's both a obligation, not both, three things, it is all of the aspects of an obligation and honor and a possibility when I spin that around in my head.
Why the word honor?
Because it does feel like an act of trust when folks in jails, mental health facilities, recovery centers, homeless shelters who really don't have any reason to trust talk about things that are very personal and very guarded. And I think that I want to make sure that I handle that responsibly. And it's an honor to be, you know, privileged to be part of something so sacred.
That's the thing that I think about a lot. You know, I returned to activism during George Floyd, and we were in Atlanta, and one of the people that I made contact with was a guy named Marshall Rancifer, and he ran something called the Justice for All Coalition, and that was the most on-site aid for the homeless in Atlanta that there was, mm-hmm. outside of maybe the Gateway Center in town. But Marshall was somebody who spent his entire life fundraising, but also was out on the streets like on a nightly basis until 2 and 3 a.m. And he would say, you know, I can get lots of people to donate. I can get lots of people to come to an event. I can get people to do so and so and so and so, you know, over the course of a year. But the number of people who will come out with me and interface with people that are being affected by all of this is very, very few. And he's like, many nights it's just me out by myself. If somebody, you know, is in really dire need of housing or has some situation like that. And it's, you know, he used to call them his clients. He's passed away as of a year ago. But yeah, definitely it's, and especially, you know, I do a lot of interfacing with nonprofits now. And they're often talking about how do we talk about these issues that we are supposed to be dealing with, because sometimes they're so sensitive that even talking about them brings a question of exploitation or, you know, ethical guidelines or this or that. And it takes both a really trained eye in the publishing process, because I've definitely been in situations in Atlanta where, you know, two Black women have a conversation and then it gets hand over to a guy who's in charge of a committee, and then it changed. Then the one guy is going yelling at the other person, and now it's just a nightmare because you're dealing with something that's really sensitive, and you want to, number one, motivate people, but also not come off as like you're just being gaudy for clout.
And you nailed it, because the word exploitation, I didn't say it out loud yet, but it's absolutely on my mind. And I think that there are ways to tell these stories that are vivid and raw and would bring attention. And, you know, with the current state of media and infotainment, we have, you know, only so many seconds, let's forget minutes, but to grab attention and to also kind of trigger people's emotional, whatever that is, emotional reactivity. But, you know, when you talk about George Floyd, and we're talking about, you know, justice reform and, you know, race, and I'm often looking at justice reform and race and trying to look at myself as a spokesperson and move away from myself and make sure that, you know, people who are most equipped and experienced be the spokespeople. And, you know, now I'm rambling, but also like sexual assault is more my bandwidth, having practiced law in sexual assault cases for, you know, a number of years. And make sure that, you know, you also brought up, you know, gender, and making sure people with the most experience have, I don't want to say the loudest voice, but the central voice in everything we talk about.
And I wouldn't consider gender to be a diversion from the conversation of power relationships and personal narratives. I mean, most industries are built on control over who's telling their story and where. Especially if the victims are in an extremely sensitive position, like if they're women or children, obviously that has a whole separate radar.
Yep.
What I really want to do is just talk to you about some of your history, what drove you to Writers Without Margins, how it started, how people can get involved. And I want to go down that road, but I also want to ask you, what are the big power relationships that underline how Writers Without Margins realistically works? Like, who helps it be funded? Does it run off publicity? Is it relationships with donors? How do you manage this scale and survival of the organization?
Oh, these are all the very, very big questions. Where do you want to start?
Well, just what are the major fundraising events or donor relationships?
So there's sort of the pre and post pandemic realities, I think, for us as well as everyone else. I'll talk about it as if the pandemic didn't happen. It's that we have, which is not real, but we have one public fundraiser a year, which we just had in May. We've moved away from the holidays because there's just too many competitive too much competition with holidays. There's kind of that one week where everybody's either at a holiday event or a fundraiser, it seems. And we did okay with that. We did better than we do during the holidays. So I think that's our new normal is to do something around the springtime. We have a relationship with the academic world in terms of our facilitators that are I don't like the word teaching, who facilitate our workshops, have a lot of relationships with the academic world. A lot of them are adjunct professors. So we have, I'd say, facilitators are the professors, artists, therapists, and folks who have come up from the workshops themselves. And I always have co-facilitators for a reason, because I think that, both the life experience and the informed experience in mental health, art, and literature is kind of the amalgamation of how we run our workshops. But I bring up that the academic cycle and the academic years are also part of our structure. So doing it in May was important, but I'd say one live fundraiser a year is about all we can handle because I'm wearing a lot of hats and we try and do it big. That broke the mold a little bit with that because one of our board members is a woman named Natalia Livingston who lives in Atlanta. And we have an interesting relationship with Atlanta because we did a documentary with Natalia because she was going to do a promotional video for us. And that turned into a feature-length documentary a couple years ago. And she runs a group called Actor Boutique out of Atlanta. She and I were friends in LA. She moved back to Atlanta, where she's from. And I say young man because he was like 20 something when he directed it, and it's a few years back now. He was also from Atlanta. So they flew into Atlanta. And when we realized we couldn't cover this story in a video that was ripe for telling, it was about four men in prison reentry or coming out of prison into reentry and during in addiction recovery. And there was a bigger story to be told. And they let us follow them for a year. He and she stayed very involved with us. And we did a big fundraiser in Atlanta last year. So I think we could probably, if we had the support, do two fundraisers a year if we worked with other communities. Because that went as well as anything we've done with Boston. Boston is challenging. I don't know why.
How big was that event in terms of people there? How much managing did you have to do to pull off that event?
Well, it was like for once I had help, and she was friends with a woman who.
Sorry.
It's true. For once I had help, and I've never ever thought like that anyone from outside of Boston was going to care about Boston workshops, and I've always given conflicted answers on that. Like, no, I can't ask for money outside of Boston. But what we did was we showed the documentary two nights in a row, and they cared about the subjects in the documentary. And we got a match from LinkedIn because this woman worked in LinkedIn. So we raised, $10,000 and got it doubled. And that is as much money as we've ever made. I'm very transparent about money. I probably shouldn't be, but it's just, I don't hide the ball. And it went incredibly well. So I do think if we were going to do things in outside communities and use the documentary, our story, which is why we did it, was to kind of have these hard conversations and throw an event like that and make it about the film, then
Yeah.
that potential.
First of all, I was gonna start talking to you about things that I saw in common with your story, and then they started piling up, and it became like I've got three different tabs that correlate the things that you talked about here. So, in terms of returning citizens, I had a really long relationship. I mean, I guess I still do with Shannon Smith, who did 25 years and is now a returned citizen in Athens and Atlanta. We did a podcast episode together. She graduated from Life University and wrote a book. And she did some workshops with an organization that she met after Life University that she doesn't even like me to name, but she's done seminars and workshops and stuff like that. And we did a couple of podcast episodes with them. Also, when it comes to running these in-person shops. First of all, I know where Actor Boutique is.
You do?
I don't know if they're still open, but I definitely have driven by them like during the pandemic. I don't know if they're still like around, but they're 20-minute drive from me. They're in the middle of the party. They're in the middle of the fun part of town. Yeah, I know where they're at. I've seen their sign before.
I love that we may have some friends in common because I met so many people from Actor Boutique that night, and I knew a couple of the folks that were going there from years past, and it's a really supportive, energized community in that world. I was like, why we Boston is a don't get me started on Boston. Boston's challenging. I'm not from here, and coming here, it's, you know, there are a lot of stereotypes about having the need to be entrenched, and I always say California, every new idea is a good idea, and you have to be proven wrong. And here, it's a lot about, like, you know, you need centuries and generations.
When I was in my 20s, I had a fiance that lived in Holbrook. So I went up and back and forth, I'd say every 3 months for a couple of years, and we went back and forth. And so I've seen a lot of Boston as a tourist, I'd put it like that, excursions into town.
We have this kind of balance, or even like a conflict. We haven't really struck the balance, and I think is, you know, we're dealing with these serious subjects, but we also, it's not lost on me that we need to be entertaining and we need to be captivating. And I think, I mean, you're talking about HIV, so like you get it. You know, it's how do we do that? How do we do that visually so that people pay attention? If I'm going to talk about, like, you know, incarceration and addiction and, you know, mental health, like, how do I still keep an audience engaged? And I mean, I dare say, like, entertained, because there's a lot of levity and there's a lot of joy also in our groups. And like the people are, I mean, speaking for myself, because I know I look like a middle class white woman, so I'll just say, like, shockingly relatable when they're, you know, living on the streets. And like they know that about me. They'll say I'm shockingly relatable because they don't expect a lot of what they don't expect either. So, and they actually don't know an awful lot about my background. I don't go in there and tell my life story either, but like there's those moments where you're just kind of like, all right, you know, and you don't have to say a lot. But the reality is, if we can feel something when we show what we show and convey something in these visually interesting ways, like you just did, that are creative and original and real, that's what we want. And if the ultimate aim sometimes is fundraising, great, but we can't constantly be like, give us money.
I was actually going to ask you this. What is the internal ecosystem of Writers Without Margins look like? Is it for the average person that journey with your organization isn't just a donation? Do they become a member? Do they attend workshops? How do they plug in? What's the easiest thing that makes them plug in, and just how do they stay connected?
Like what does it mean to, you know, join us or follow us or be part of our community? What do we mean?
What does it mean to support?
So again, I would love to, I don't want to inundate you either because you talk to a lot of people, but this journal that we just created, I would love to send you a copy of it because that would be
You absolutely should.
okay. So like we send donors, partners, people that show up at our events, this journal every year, and that is a collection of our writers. So like having the journal, I said we do one fundraiser a year. We also do a lot of events. All of our events are free and open to the public. So we did, you know, a bunch of film screenings when the film first was completed. We're at the Boston Film Festival. We also were at like lots of libraries and theaters, and we did a friends and family event, which pretty much meant anyone. And we do a lot of things like that. We're at different community colleges. So everything we do is free and open to the public in terms of events. And as much as possible, we try and have them be like about representation. Like it'll be a it was an event and, you know, guys that were in the film did a Q&A afterwards. So it's always about like the people from, we're about to do October 23rd, a contributor reading from the workshop. So there'll be like 10 of the writers in the workshop getting up reading. And that sounds super boring to go to a poetry reading. Like, I mean, I have an MFA in poetry and I know poetry readings are super boring, but ours is very unpredictable. And when, like, I will acknowledge that it's unpredictable in a way that makes me really nervous, but unpredictable in a way that is entertaining. People get up and say the most random things you could imagine. And it's always like weird and fun. So we do that event, come to our events, read our journal, come to film screenings.
Are a lot of this in person versus hybrid? What is the mix?
We never really got that good at, when I say I'm going to talk like the pandemic didn't happen, we never got that good at being online. So we did online workshops when the pandemic existed, because we also have a relationship with the Boston Public Library. So we did all of our workshops with the Boston Public Library online, and we reached a lot of people that like weren't coming out of their houses and never would have met each other otherwise. They were like the true public community. But most of our, you know, our shelters, jails, reentry centers, they are very like critical basic services. They don't have Zoom rooms. They were all about social distancing. We're on hiatus with all of them. We're back with all of them, bigger than ever, but that was all on hold. So what I did was like a writing prompt of the week every week for 52 weeks. And I sent those out to, you know, hundreds of people so that they were getting like constant communication from me, which was like, you know, let's do nature, but let's do human nature. And it was like, here's an example from a contemporary poet. Here's a prompt and here's some thoughts about it. So I was just like trying to bombard people with, you know, love through literature, but we were, we were kind of backed off. And, you know, we did our annual literary journal based on our online workshops, but our online workshops took a different spin just through, you know, the public libraries, branch libraries all over the city.
Do you guys want to raise more money? Are you having meetings about we should raise more money and we should get things in the hands of donors and start making lists and doing all of that? Or is there an air of, we're okay right now, what's next? We're all tired.
The only reason we're not okay, and we're never too tired. Like, I'm always energized by like meeting somebody that I get excited about, which it's not easy for me to do because I also get jaded by people. I'm always just like, but constantly excited. Like, I'm excited now, so I don't get tired. The reason we always need more money is we are always trying to go new places. So there's always more shelters, more recovery centers, more mental health facilities that we could be at. So we're never secure financially for that reason. I don't owe anybody money. All of our facilitators get paid. Like, everybody's good, except there's always more work to do.